This week, Attorney General Bill Barr released a redacted version of the Mueller report. Although he refused to release the full version to Congress, Barr provided a copy to Trump's attorneys in advance. Despite the redactions, the version of the Mueller report released by Barr paints a detailed and damning picture of Trump, his campaign, and his associates. What can we learn from an initial look at the redacted Mueller report? What should we make of Barr's attempts to deceive the public? And what happens from here? Let's get on topic. Welcome to On Topic, a weekly in-depth look at a topic that helps us understand the week's news. My name is Renato Mariotti. I'm a former federal prosecutor, a practicing lawyer, and a CNN legal analyst. And I'm joined by my friend Patty Vasquez, a WGN radio host who will join us regularly on this podcast. So, Patty, I have to tell you, the release of the Mueller report was absolutely insane. And in multiple levels, I will talk a little later about why Mr. Barr's behavior, the attorney general's behavior, was so outrageous.
Troubling, would you say?
Troubling is an understatement. I wrote my column in Politico.
It's a great piece.
Thank you. I put a lot of effort into that one because I was so enraged and disturbed by his behavior. But on another note, you know, this is a 440-something page document. And I'm going to already tell everyone up front, I have not read and digested this entire document. In other words, I'm used to reading legal documents quickly. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons why I'm usually able to quickly write Twitter threads and so forth. But this is such a dense document. There's so much there. That I think that, you know, once I get some sleep, because I've been on TV a lot over CNN over late at night. But once I get some sleep, I'm going to be spending hours looking through this thing, and I'm going to probably see a lot more than I'm going to see now. Well, but we can talk more about that in the future. But I'm bringing all these people with different perspectives who hopefully focus on different parts of the report. I've certainly read a lot of it very carefully, and I've really tried to zoom in on the parts that I thought were the most important. And I think there's a lot there, and there's a lot for us to discuss. This is, without a doubt, an important moment in American history. Everyone should take a look at this report very closely for themselves.
Well, I'll do my best, but I do like the way you broke it down and the idea that Mueller had more than enough evidence and information, but that since he couldn't take Trump, I know we're going to talk a lot about this, but that to me, I think, is such a great summary and explanation of how this all unfolded and why we are where we are right now.
Well, one thing I'm very certain about is that if we did not have the Barr letter and all that shenanigans, people would have looked at this very differently. I think any fair-minded person reading the obstruction section here saw a prosecutor laying out the case to charge the president. One conservative commentator who I disagree with on almost every issue said that it read to him like an impeachment referral. And I think that's, in other words, it was a referral to Congress to look at obstruction of justice for impeachment purposes. There's no question in my mind that Robert Mueller believed that there was a very strong case for obstruction of justice. He just was trying to be as fair as possible to Donald Trump. I think we can explore that issue more at length with some of our guests.
Absolutely.
But I think there's a lot there. And frankly, there are footnotes and just little nuggets on pages that have very significant implications. I've been talking to people and, you know, they'll bring up, did you see page 200 and something or 100
right.
and something? I'm like, wow. No, I didn't even pay attention to that when I was reading it.
Yep.
So let's bring in Jennifer Rogers. Jennifer was a federal prosecutor in the Southern District of New York, which many of you may have heard about. She's a CNN legal analyst, and you know she was in our preview episode for the Mueller report and really had some great insights. So let's bring her in now. Welcome back, Jennifer. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Of course. Great to be here.
So I have to say, you know, I was just mentioning a moment ago that this is such a dense document. There's so much here, and it's really quite a remarkable piece of work by the part of Mr. Mueller and his team. Just at a high level, what is your reaction to this as somebody who's an experienced lawyer, former prosecutor, who is looking at this document for the first time?
Well, I agree with you. I think that the Mueller report is basically everything that we expected it to be before Bill Barr started playing mind games with us about 3 weeks ago. You know, it goes through everything that they did. It puts all the evidence out there in a digestible format. It tells us what they've done with the cases that they brought, referrals that they've made. It tells us why they made the decisions that they made. So I think it's a terrific document. It really puts everything in one place, which is so helpful for those of us trying to get our arms around what the Mueller team did here. And it explains it all in a way that I think lay people can understand. Now, that still requires them to do a lot of reading, and so most people won't. But I think they did a terrific job and a real service to the country, and I think the report is the culmination of all of that.
You know, it's interesting, Jennifer, you mentioned the mind games that Barr played, and I will tell you that was my first reaction to all of this. We had that press conference that Barr called yesterday before the release of the report, in which he revealed that he had already given advance copy of it to Trump's attorneys, including, I believe, his personal attorneys. And essentially, he tried to spin this for the Trump administration. I think he gave very much the party line of, the no collusion and so forth. He gave a number of statements that it turned out later to be highly, I would say, are highly deceptive in that press conference. You know, did you have a similar reaction to that rollout that I did?
I did. I thought it was really outrageous. I mean, even sitting watching the press conference before we saw the document, you could tell that he was, at first I thought he was spinning. I thought that the March 24th letter you could call spinning. And of course, it's hard to say before you see what it is he's talking about. But the press conference was even a step beyond. It was like, you know, he was almost just acting as Trump's personal attorney. I mean, taking what he said and just giving the talking points and not a fair recitation of what it was. I mean, we even knew before, having seen the Mueller report, that it wasn't going to be what he said, because it wasn't going to be no obstruction. You know, he gave us enough in his March 24th letter that we knew that wasn't going to be true. So that whole episode is so strange. And, you know, it's neither here nor there, really, but a lot of people I'm talking to are saying, why in the world would Bill Barr do this, kind of come back, you know, out of the private sector to take this high profile job only to kind of ruin his reputation in service of this president? And, no one has any answers. But I think it's a really disturbing episode, and also just doesn't bode well for how the Department of Justice is going to be led for the next year and a half or so, at least.
There, a lot of people want to know whether or not is there any accountability for Barr? Is there any way to impeach him?
There is. I mean, you can impeach any executive branch official. And one question that I've been asked, both by folks at CNN and by lawmakers, is whether that's a potential course of action. I don't think that it'll go to the end there, for the same reason that I think there aren't going to be necessarily votes in the Senate to remove Donald Trump. But I think there's no question in my mind that Barr deceived the United States Senate. You know, he obtained that job with some Democratic votes, a bipartisan vote, because he promised a commitment to full transparency. There's no question that he lied, in my mind, that he lied to the United States Senate about it. I mean, here's a man who still is not committed to give the full report to the House of Representatives, which has a constitutional duty to take a look at and examine criminal investigations of the president. And frankly, for the last 25 days, we had this letter that contained a number of half-truths and misleading statements, far from a commitment to transparency. But I don't think that anything will happen to him. But as Jennifer said, his reputation is tarnished. How do you feel about that, Jennifer?
Yeah, I agree with you. And the other thing that was so strange that happened that we realized as soon as we got the report was, you know, whereas Barr had said that Mueller refused to decide about the obstruction question and basically dodged the reason why. You know, people kept asking him, did he say why? And he's kind of like, oh, you know, I don't know. But that left it to me. And of course, prosecutors have to make these decisions. So I did, and I decided there wasn't enough evidence. I mean, that is so wrong once you read the report. And I, you know, I'm sure you want to get into the substance of this later on about the obstruction and the strong case that's made out there. But when you read that, you can't possibly see how someone in the attorney general's position can read that report and say, yeah, there's not enough on the merits, having nothing to do with the fact that the president can't legally be prosecuted according to DOJ. You know, it's just kind of mind-boggling, and yet we're supposed to accept that prosecutorial decision that he made, not knowing nearly as much about the case as Mueller does, and having read the report, which is so damning on the obstruction question. So, you know, I just feel like on the merits of Bill Barr as leading the Justice Department as he is now, we kind of have to take everything he's doing there with a grain of salt and think about what his motives are.
Well, no question. I mean, I have to say I'm embarrassed that Bill Barr is my attorney general. He didn't, you know, during that press conference, he actually said at one point that Robert Mueller prepared this for me and he did this for me. And I was very upset by that because, of course, Robert Mueller worked for the American people and so does Bill Barr. You know, you had mentioned a moment ago, Jennifer, you know, a lot of people are wondering why he would tarnish his legacy in this way. You know, I've thought about it myself. And, you know, I will say that, you know, Bill Barr struck me as someone who would potentially wanted to be relevant again. I mean, here's somebody who was, you know, an important figure, obviously, during the George Herbert Walker Bush administration. That was in, you know, the very early 90s. It's over 20 years ago. And, you know, I you know, he obviously had some level of a law practice, but had enough time to write 19-page single-space memos to the administration about his views on obstruction of justice. So, you know, I wonder if he's a character like Ty Cobb or Rudy Giuliani or John Dowd, folks who are eager to be in the mix, you know, like they had been in times past.
Yeah, who knows? I mean, you can only hope, though, now that he's maybe regretting it, having gotten himself into this situation. And I'm sure he's seeing some of the commentary out there about what he's doing. And hopefully it disturbs them. I mean, hopefully he takes all of this in and switches course a little bit. But I guess we'll have to wait and see.
Indeed. I will say, Jennifer, that I have seen some of the opposite. I mean, I was really disappointed to see some conservatives, probably right-wing commentators, you know, cheering on Barr and his performance yesterday. Mm-hmm. Because to me, you know, you had mentioned a moment ago about his deception regarding obstruction. I mean, he literally lied during the press conference because he was asked by the first reporter who asked him a question whether or not the DOJ policy regarding the OLC policy regarding the indictment of a sitting president had anything to do with Mueller's non-decision on obstruction. And the clear answer is, yes, it did. I mean, I don't think you could escape that answer from reading the report. But he went out of his way to, in a way that he could argue is technically accurate based on some private conversation he had with Mueller, to say, well, you know, technically it wasn't due to the policy, but it was very highly misleading because it was due to concerns arising from that policy. I thought that he took from, you know, Mueller was somebody on that question, and we can get to this in a moment, but he, you know, Mueller was somebody throughout this process who showed a great sense of humility and restraint, and Barr showed everything the opposite of that.
Yeah, I agree. And it'll be interesting to see whether Mueller, when he testifies, how forthcoming he is. You know, is he upset about this turn of events? And if so, is he going to tell us that, or is he going to continue to be, you know, fairly close-lipped about it and just say what he needs to say and not get into that fight, if you will, with Bill Barr? I'm inclined to think he won't, because he doesn't seem like that kind of guy, but part of me wishes he would just take the gloves off and let him have it.
I have the same view as you, Jennifer, which is I'd love to have Robert Mueller say something about this, but I suspect he won't. I think he'll answer questions honestly, and if lawmakers ask him the right questions, I think he will give honest answers. You know, if he's asked about whether Barr's statements were misleading or something like that, I think he will answer accurately because that's the kind of man he is. He's not somebody who would not be truthful, but I don't think he's going to go out of his way to one way or the other to make any sort of a statement. I guess, you know, we've been talking a lot about obstruction. From my perspective, that is legally the most consequential part of the report. Do you agree?
I do, because, you know, you could say that the conduct of Trump and the campaign on the kind of Russian conspiracy side of things was not good. It's not what we would want. But everyone is clear that they didn't find evidence of a crime. And, you know, so that kind of is where it ends. That's kind of where it sits. And, you know, there's really no recourse even in Congress for the kind of bad behavior that we saw during the campaign with respect to the Russian interference. But on the obstruction side of the House, I mean, holy moly, they set out a very strong case for obstruction of justice on at least, by my count, 6 or 7 of the 10 episodes that they considered in the report, going through the legal elements and putting them up against the facts, basically saying, all of the elements are made here. Now, they don't take the final jump and say, and therefore the president has committed a crime, because as they told us earlier on in the report, they weren't going to do that. But it really does leave it open for maybe a future criminal prosecution if the president doesn't win a second term and anyone, you know, has the appetite to do that, for impeachment in Congress. I mean, there were crimes committed here, according to the Mueller report, in my view. And that's where it's so stunning of a document and where it's so glaringly obvious that Barr misled the American people by saying there is no crime here.
Yeah, I agree with you, Jennifer. I think your analysis, as usual, spot on. I do. The reason I stressed sort of the importance of it is there have been some people who have still, but you know, some whether you want to call them commentators or theorists or whatever, who've been maintaining that, well, actually the conspiracy part of the report's the most important, that it vindicates whatever view people had about that. I think. My view is exactly identical to yours, which is, look, there's a lot of very troubling things in that part of the report, because there's two parts of the report. But as a legal matter, you know, there's nothing that establishes a crime. And really, and I want to have you sort of walk through why you felt there was strong evidence and what exactly Mueller sets out on obstruction. But that's where all of the legal action is and will be likely in the weeks and months to come.
Before we go on to the obstruction, though, I do have to ask, because some of the listeners have been posting about this, and I'm curious, too, because it looks like, for example, the Trump Tower meeting where the Crown Prosecutor of Russia offered to provide the Trump campaign with some official documents and information that would incriminate Hillary Clinton didn't lead to any prosecutions, not because it wasn't illegal, but because the government would unlikely be able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the June 9th meeting participants had general knowledge that their conduct was unlawful. So ignorance of the law is the reason why they felt that they couldn't prosecute?
So, you know, it's only in very specific areas of the law. So tax law and campaign finance law are areas where you have to know that you're doing something that violates what's called a known legal duty. And the reason why, think about it, Patty, let's say you're in your taxes, you have a statement that you make a statement that turns out to be false. Like, do you want to go to prison for that? Even if, you know, it's some arcane thing in the tax laws. The idea is that in some of these arcane areas of the law, we have a higher bar. Is that it? Would you agree, Jennifer?
Okay, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah. I mean, it's what's called a specific intent crime. You know, you have to know more than just in the average case. You have to know more than it's just kind of a generally wrong thing to do. You have to know that it's actually against the law. And you know, that's because it doesn't necessarily occur to people that it's illegal to accept something of value in a campaign from a foreign source. And also the other thing is campaign finance law it's not something that's charged very often criminally. Those matters are usually resolved civilly or by the campaign just correcting it on its own or after consultation with the FEC. So this just isn't an area of criminal law that's very well developed. But as I read, there aren't cases that this kind of thing of value has been settled as a contribution. So while you can say, sure, it's a value to the campaign to get opposition research or dirt on your opponent, that hasn't been in a published criminal case used as the thing of value that's required by the statute. So that was another hurdle for them, I think. They just thought this would really be a reach, a very aggressive prosecution, and they didn't think they could bring it.
Very spot on by Jennifer. One thing I would just add, just to help people understand, that the crime here is would be that you are accepting money from a foreign national, and here in the money, when I say money, you know, as Jennifer points out, that it's contribution, and here it's unclear whether, like, you know, dirt that you don't end up even get, you know, unnamed vague dirt is in fact a contribution because it may not have even existed. But to give an example that would be more typical, you could imagine a campaign in which somebody accepts a check from somebody who's a resident or a citizen of the UK or a citizen of Canada, and then realize that they are not able to accept $1,000 from a Canadian citizen. Did that person commit a felony? That's why there's a willfulness requirement that requires that they did something that's against the law in that context. And Jennifer's right that those crimes are often not charged criminally. We've had episodes where we've talked a lot about campaign finance law in another context in the Southern District of New York case. But I think, you know, one thing that you said, Jennifer, I thought that was very valuable is you talked about how aggressive that case would be. And I think part of the point here is not to treat, let's say in this case, Donald Trump Jr., differently than we would treat other types of defendants. And that was the same impulse that Comey had with Hillary Clinton. In other words, we don't usually prosecute people. We never had at that point prosecuted anybody for inadvertently mishandling classified material. We shouldn't start doing that for the first time with Hillary Clinton.
That's right. And I think it kind of dovetails with the way that the Mueller team has handled this whole investigation. They've been, you know, conservative, not in the political sense, but in the legal sense, in terms of being cautious with the cases they brought. Every case was very, very strong and based on sound legal theories that have been used over and over again. So it just kind of goes in with the mix of how they've treated everything.
I agree with you. You know, and that's something that I think kind of really dovetails into our obstruction piece of this, because, you know, in my column that I wrote about the Barr's deception and the obstruction piece of this, which I thought I agree with you is very strong. You know, I talk about how Mueller showed great restraint, humility and fair play and how he dealt with the president on the issue of obstruction of justice. You know, ultimately what Mueller said was, well, you know, since he can't charge the president, he was not going to reach a legal conclusion because of fairness concerns that he had. Those are the exact words, fairness concerns, because his concern was, you know, ordinarily, if one of my clients, for example, is indicted with something, I can go to court and we can challenge it. We can have various motions, so we can go have a speedy trial, public trial, and potentially win. But, you know, Trump wouldn't have that opportunity. I wouldn't have come to the same conclusion. I would think that, you know, he would have a trial in the Senate, and that's what a president deserves. But I respect Robert Mueller for having a sense of humility and fair play. I don't think I would ever criticize a prosecutor for that. And I've been surprised to see some people highly critical. Ron Klain is one, but there have been others highly critical of Robert Mueller for having that sense of humility and restraint. How do you come out on that?
Yeah, it's really interesting because I, along with many others, was just, I didn't know why he wouldn't reach a conclusion. It didn't make any sense to me. And I thought if it was because of the OLC opinion, then he would just say, listen, I can't bring these charges and that's why I didn't. But let me tell you why I would have and could have. And here's why the evidence shows that a crime was committed. And it didn't really occur to me, to be honest, because I just thought, you know, they're going to lay it all out and we're going to know the answer one way or the other. But having read it and thought about it for a bit, you know, I don't know that I would have done it that way, but I also respect that decision. I feel like there is a fairness component to that. Now, on the flip side, is it fair that the president gets a pass while he's the president? You know, he's the only person in America who can't be charged with the conduct that we now know he has committed. But if you put that aside for the moment, it would put a huge cloud over the presidency to say, listen, the president committed a crime and he can be charged the moment he leaves office, but he can't be charged now. And so let's all just live with that for the rest of his tenure. And so I see why he did what he did. The problem with it is it still feels just a little misleading, because when you read the report, I come to the conclusion that there is a crime there and that the Mueller team thought so. And yet he didn't go so far as to say it. So we're kind of left in the little bit of this gray area that allows the president and his supporters to say things that I think are not really accurate, right? That he's been exonerated, that there is no crime. And that includes Bill Barr, who shockingly, on the evidence that he saw before him, and also, by the way, without any explanation at all, tells us that there isn't enough evidence, which is just crazy to me, because I don't think that he's planning on giving us any more on that. I mean, maybe he will in testimony, but I wouldn't anticipate any more written documents. But after this, you know, 400 and some page report, he just tells us, oh, and by the way, there wasn't enough evidence, without kind of tackling point by point, you know, here's why, even though the Mueller team spells it all out for you, here's why this piece of evidence doesn't suffice. Here's why this element isn't met. We don't have any of that to try to make sense of what Bill Barr has done.
Yeah, it's an excellent point, Jennifer. I agree with you. And, you know, what really the letter in retrospect is very highly misleading. You know, he talks about that Mueller laying out evidence on both sides. He doesn't put any evidence on the other side. In other words, Mueller doesn't say, here's, you know, walk through, here's all this evidence that Trump didn't obstruct justice on these points. I mean, he'll occasionally talk about the sufficiency of the evidence, but there's not really evidence on both sides that's laid out. I think that was a highly misleading, if not false, statement. Another false statement by Barr was essentially where he says that Mueller did not come to a conclusion on obstruction due to, quote, difficult issues of law and fact. I will tell you, when I was previewing the Mueller report and said, what am I going to be looking for? I focused on what possible difficult issues of fact there were, because I had concluded a year ago that Trump had obstructed justice. I'm trying to figure out what are the difficult issues of fact. Turns out when you look at this, Mueller wasn't grappling with difficult issues of fact. That was pure deception. And really, because, as you mentioned, Jennifer, because Mueller didn't reach a conclusion, I mean, there's a very perverse effect here. You know, Mueller in the report says that if Congress, and he lays out and explains why Congress needs to be able to, he kind of debunks Barr's theory that none of this could be obstruction of justice for legal reasons, and says that Congress has to be able to enforce this type of obstruction of justice, because if it couldn't do that, the president would be above the law. But I think that because Mueller didn't reach a conclusion, there is an element to which Trump is above the law. And really, Barr's deception played into that, because, as you point out, there's an element of vagueness here. I mean, I was on the air this morning on CNN arguing very aggressive. I mean, David Gregory and I had a full-blown argument on the air, because he was saying there's no evidence of obstruction, no evidence of, you know, I'm like, that's not what the report says. There's clearly a case of obstruction of justice that was made here, and Robert Mueller didn't make it because this man is the president of the United States, and that is unfortunately easily obscured.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I think we know why Barr claimed that Mueller struggled with difficult issues of fact. It's because he didn't want to just say that the issues here were legal issues, right? Because he doesn't want the American people to know that the president is escaping prosecution just because he's the president. So instead, he wants to tell us, yeah, oh, yeah, lots of evidence on both sides, very tough. You know, Mueller couldn't reach a decision. Well, as you said, that's not what the report says. And, you know, he does say here and there, there are a couple of the episodes of obstruction where, you know, he says, you know, oh, there's not quite enough or what have you, like on the Trump Tower meeting, cover-up stuff. But for the most part, he finds that all three elements that he goes through are met. And so, you know, yeah, that was very misleading by Barr. And, you know, I really just can't wait for them to get Barr back. I mean, Mueller will be interesting, but I think, you know, Barr will be more interesting. If you get some good questioners, and that's always the question with these congressional hearings, but man, they could rip them to shreds over this stuff.
I'm available to write more questions. So.
I was hoping you
should.
Yes.
I'm curious, Jennifer, you know, could you help our listeners and walk through a little bit why, you know, we're talking about the fact that you and I have both agree that the obstruction case is laid out as to at least a number of the episodes. Very strongly, it appears from the report that Mueller and his team concluded there was obstruction. Can you kind of walk through that a little bit, explain that to all of us?
So, yeah, so they name 10 kind of factual incidences that they kind of recite the evidence that they uncovered in the investigation. And then for each of those, they go through the three important legal elements of obstruction. They consider whether there was an obstructive action. They then consider whether there was a nexus between that action and a judicial proceeding, which is what's required by the statute. And finally, they consider whether the president had the necessary intent, the intent to obstruct the judicial proceeding. And for many of these things, they determined that the answer was yes. And they don't explicitly say that. They just, in each of those three sections, conclude that there was evidence, or sometimes they say substantial evidence that, you know, for example, there was an obstructive action or the president had the necessary intent. And some of the ones that seemed the strongest to me were Jim Comey's firing, the efforts to remove the special counsel. Remember all of that detailed stuff with Don McGahn being told over and over he needed to fire the special counsel and he was refusing, and that whole episode. This new factual incident with Corey Lewandowski trying to get Jeff Sessions to end the special counsel investigation. The effort to get Sessions to unrecuse and take over the investigation again for the purpose of curtailing it. And then the things that I think maybe are getting a little bit lost in the mix here, but shouldn't, because I think they're really important and really demonstrate how bad an actor the president was in all of this, is the witness-related stuff. You know, his conduct with respect to Michael Flynn and Paul Manafort and Roger Stone, although Stone's name is redacted, and Michael Cohen, where he is using kind of his pardon powers, but also just generally other things to try to say, when they seem like they're in trouble, to kind of keep them on, you know, Team Trump, oh, stay strong, and then, you know, when they leave, as Michael Cohen did, all of a sudden he's on the attack and he's a rat and all of this, all with an eye towards influencing their testimony at a judicial proceeding. So those are another area where the special counsel found that the elements were met.
Yeah, I think that's a great summary. There was definitely some interesting new factual detail. I thought the Lewandowski piece was very interesting. Here is where essentially Trump is trying to use Corey Lewandowski, who at that point had no role, official role, as sort of a back channel to Jeff Sessions, who was recused from the Mueller investigation, trying to convince Jeff Sessions to shut it all down or to direct it only towards future elections, the Russia investigation into future elections, which, of course, was not the point. The point was to look at what Russia did in the 2016 election. And then also, as you point out, the witness tampering. And I have to say, some of the stuff that I thought was really interesting there was the behavior of the attorneys. I mean, one comment I made yesterday was that it appeared to me that some of Trump's attorneys needed their own attorneys. And what I meant by that is...
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, are you surprised, though, really?
You know, it's an interesting thing. It'd be, you know, I'm not surprised because we already had heard about their behavior with Manafort. In other words, mm-hmm. Jennifer, I was so shocked when we heard about that because just like you, I've been involved in a lot of different investigations. I've done it on both sides. I've been on the defense side, too, and I am now on various investigations. I've never heard of a situation where you're going to a cooperator and getting them to report back to you everything the prosecutor says under the guise mm-hmm. of a joint defense agreement when the guy's cooperating. So once that happened, I'm like, yeah, these guys will basically do anything. And so I wasn't that surprised. But, man, I mean, some of this, you know, texting Cohen after he lies and basically being like, the boss is happy with you. The episode with Flynn's lawyer where they're like, you know, we want to know what you got on the president, what you're telling the prosecutors, and you know, this is going to be regarded as a hostile act if you don't. I mean, it was really shocking stuff that, frankly, bar associations should take a look at.
Yeah, it's a little like the old La Cosa Nostra cases that I used to do at Southern District. It's really ham-handed and ridiculous. And, I mean, going back to the Corey Lewandowski thing, I mean, one of the things that the special counsel's report pointed out when they are analyzing the president's intent is, you know, one thing you can tell is he at first was just going straight to justice. And then his people were like, you know, you really can't do that. You don't want to be perceived as trying to influence them. So he purposefully goes outside of the White House, right, and recruits Corey Lewandowski, who's in the private sector. So when you think about the president's intent, you know, it's like, one way is kind of blocked to him, so then he thinks of another way to do it where it'll be more surreptitious, more undercover. You know, that's how you show intent, right? It's the circumstantial evidence of kind of hiding what you're doing and you know, losing access to one way and finding another roundabout way. And so the report is very clever about pointing those things out. And those are the sorts of things, as you know, Renato, really resonate with a jury when you can point something out and say, look, he was blocked in this way. And so he went around, and you can see the jurors kind of nodding and saying, yeah, you know, I get that. That's right. That's the sort of thing that the report does that I think really kind of helps the lay reader kind of grasp these concepts.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I had always thought, it's been over a year now that I've been convinced that the Trump obstructed justice just based on what we knew publicly. Now there's the additional detail to me, what it does is it really cuts the legs out from under any potential defense you could have in front of a jury. In other words, look, I try cases in front of juries now. I had a trial against the Justice Department just a week ago, and it would be really hard for me to try this case in front of a jury because, you know, some of the stuff, like, you know, one argument that Barr tried to make in the letter, which I think is totally undercut by the details in the report, is, well, Trump knew that there was nothing to the a collusion case, so that, you know, somehow goes to his intent. But, you know, if you read the report, he's basically, Trump's like, look, I'm effed. He totally thought his presidency was over. He had very strong motivations, and Mueller makes the correct argument there that is enough to give him a motivation. He doesn't need to have to know that the you know, that there was some underlying crime or anything like that. And just some of the detail, like you just mentioned a moment ago, how he tries to go through official channels and then finds his back channel through, you know, I think whatever, he may have been, I think, CNN contributor Corey Lewandowski or whatever, right? To try to obstruct justice. I think that that's just, it's very hard for a jury, if they're looking at all of this together in one case, to not conclude that there's something really effed about what the president's doing. I just think, You can make whatever kind of legal arguments, you know, Dershowitz or Barr want to make, but a jury would just look at this and I think have no trouble convicting on these facts.
Yeah, and then this was another area where Barr was so misleading in the way that he characterized how the special counsel considered this issue of, you know, with no underlying crime, how does that impact the president's intent? And, you know, Barr basically suggested, oh, this is a real non-starter. You know, once you realize there's no underlying crime, you know, game over. And that's what the special counsel thought. And, you know, the special counsel did not think that. And the New York Times did a nice kind of side-by-side of Barr's, you know, snippet from the letter and then what the special counsel actually said. And there's this very long paragraph where he says, you know, listen, it does mean you have to look for other motives. If there's no underlying crime, then you have to think about why the president would want to commit this obstructive act. But there are tons of other reasons, right? Other motives that they had, including public perceptions of things and personal reasons for wanting to do this and all of that. And that clearly was at play when you read the factual recitations in the Mueller report. So, you know, I thought that was another area where Mueller really, you know, hammered the point home, but Barr misled us about it.
Yeah, so, you know, just to pivot for a minute and talk a little bit about some of the steps to come. You know, one bone of contention the day before the report was released was, why isn't Nadler pushing for a subpoena right now? And I thought, I was defending Nadler. I know Lawrence Tribe and others were on the other side of that. But, you know, it seemed to me that, you know, now Nadler has issued a subpoena for the entire Mueller report and the underlying evidence. And I think he's on very, very firm constitutional ground, given that they have, the House has an impeachment role. He's got jurisdiction over impeachment as the chair of the Judiciary Committee. And I thought he was really smart to wait for Barr to commit to not give Congress everything. I mean, he now, Barr has said that he's only going to give them redacted versions of the report. I'm curious what your thought is about how that litigation is going to play out.
Yeah, it's hard to say. You know, to be honest, I haven't done kind of congressional subpoena litigation, so I don't know so much about how the court will view that as opposed to the kind of subpoena that we deal with all the time. I think Congress has a very strong argument that they should get it. And, you know, the nice thing is we already know that Barr refused to agree to go to court to seek release of the grand jury materials restricted by Rule 6E. So now they can kind of do it all in one fell swoop, right? You go to court to try to enforce your subpoena, which, of course, he will refuse to comply with. And at the same time, you know, you can argue to the judge why these materials should be released. I think they have good cause to get it. I don't know how there can be an argument that Congress isn't capable of keeping the things confidential that need to be confidential and that sort of thing. I mean, you can say that Congress leaked like a sieve all you want, but that's not really going to carry the day, I don't think, in a legal litigation about what Congress is entitled to have in this matter of such importance to the nation. So I assume they'll win that litigation, and that at this point it's really just a delay tactic, and they just kind of hope that they can kick the can down the road long enough so that the public's appetite is less than it is now, and you know, people will be paying even less attention than they are now.
I agree with you, Jennifer. I do think that that's what Barr's motives are. I don't see any way in which a court's going to say that the executive branch can selectively hide portions of a criminal investigation of the president from the House of Representatives. I refuse to believe that we've reached the point in this country where our judiciary would allow that to happen. But I do think that, you know, the judiciary often wants to punt on issues where there's a political squabble between different branches of government. And I did like the fact that Nadler made sure the issue was fully ripe and where there could be no dispute that there was clearly a decision by the executive branch not to release information to him. I wonder, going forward now, there's obviously been some debate about how Congress should go going forward. There was a comment by Steny Hoyer saying that impeachment essentially was unwise. We heard Ocasio-Cortez say she's signing an impeachment resolution, and then Nancy Pelosi's kind of left the door open. I'm just curious if you have any thoughts about where we go from here, what people can expect, because I think a lot of listeners are wondering what all of this means.
Yeah, I don't know, obviously, what the House will do. That's a political question. I mean, I'm sure Nancy Pelosi, as much as she personally would love to impeach the president, obviously is thinking about the politics in the 2020 election. And so she doesn't seem to be on board. Obviously, we know it's a no-go in the Senate. So that's just a calculation they'll have to make. I'm wondering how this testimony will go. You know, they're going to haul Barr up there. They're going to have Mueller come in. I'm wondering if Barr is going to issue anything else. You know, what's he going to say about this conclusion that he made, that there was no obstruction on the facts we have? I'm wondering if the president and his lawyers are going to release the counter report that they were supposedly drafting like mad. You know, we haven't seen any of that. This could continue to play out. And at the same time, I guess there was a poll from 2 days ago that like 54% of the people polled thought that Congress should just move on. So, you know, kind of all those things kind of point in different directions. But I don't know. I can't read the political winds well enough to know whether it's smart or not. You get the feeling in your gut that this president ought to be impeached for what he's done. And certainly the legal case is more than strong enough to impeach him. But whether that's smart or not for the Dems going into 2020, that's what I don't know.
Yeah, I respect your approach on that. I would say basically the same thing, Jennifer, which is there's clearly a legal basis to impeach the president. I really don't have a lot of doubt that if you put me in front of a jury, I could prove based on this evidence that he obstructed justice to a jury. What this means for impeachment, I don't know, because of the political realities that are beyond my expertise or yours. Reading the minds of Republican senators or public opinion or so forth. One thing I will say, though, is, you know, there's still been a lot of questions that people have had about oh, well, there'll be other lawsuits, other investigations, other indictments that are going to have some major impact on the Trump presidency. I don't know what is redacted here, these different matters that have been spun off, but there was a lot of questions about that. And all, one thing I would just, my view to listeners, and I'll be interested in yours before we wrap up, is I would not sit at home and expect that some lawyer somewhere is going to come out and just and make the 2020 election a non-issue for everyone. In other words, don't sit back at home and expect that some lawyer is going to come in and save America for you. You're going to actually have to get off your butts and vote and get involved and organize and do all the things that you would ordinarily do to try to win an election. I would not expect that to happen. I'm curious what your view is, Jennifer.
Yeah, I mean, so the redacted ongoing investigations are interesting, but 12, I think, of them, almost all of them, are in the category of matters that came up during the special counsel's investigation but were not within their mandate, and so they, you know, punted those. So those are not likely to be super interesting because they don't pertain to the Russian interference and the campaign's involvement or obstruction in that realm. So those, I think, are going to be kind of more random here and there. And then, you know, there's one that is a matter of ongoing investigation that has to do with Manafort and the money that he got from Ukraine back in the day. So, you know, that also, I think, is unlikely to be a blockbuster when it's revealed. So I agree. I wouldn't expect there to be anything to blow the top off of anything. I don't think Don Jr. is going to be indicted or anything like that. And frankly, even if he was, I don't know that takes down this presidency or anything, right, given what we've already seen. People are just shrugging off. So I agree with you. You know, get out the vote. That's what we need for 2020. It's not going to be the redacted portions of the Mueller report.
Well, Jennifer, thank you. I think that's a great message. And frankly, I really appreciate your sort of careful and thoughtful approach to all of this. Thank you for breaking this down with us. You know, there's been a lot. There's a lot to go through. And at least this is a very good first take that I hope will help people get a sense of some of the legal issues that we're all looking at in this report.
Yeah, it's really fun to talk it through, and I think your views are terrific and align with mine, and it's fun to bounce these off each other, and I appreciate you inviting me on.
Our next guest needs absolutely no introduction because she was the recent guest host of On Topic, Asha Rankappa, who is a former FBI counterintelligence agent, current professor at Yale at Yale University, and of course my former classmate and a CNN legal analyst and national security analyst. Welcome back, Asha.
Thanks, Renato. Thanks for having me on.
So, Asha, I have spent all this time talking with Jennifer Rogers about part two of the Mueller report. And I got to say, it seems a little backwards in a way because the entire investigation was really spurred by initially by a desire to, learn the answers to part one. And I think most of our listeners' questions are about part one of the report, which deals with coordination and or collusion or conspiracy with Russia. And I think it's kind of maybe as a starting point, I'd be interested in, you explaining to us sort of how Mueller tackled that concept of collusion, because, of course, that's not a concept that has legal meaning in criminal law.
That's right. And he acknowledges that explicitly in the report. What he says is the word collusion does not have legal meaning under the U.S. code. And so he says that he is approaching these actions from the point of view of criminal law, and he's looking at two things. One is conspiracy, which is an agreement to commit a crime and would also require an overt act in furtherance of that crime. And he looks at something slightly below that. He also looks at something that he calls coordination, but he defines coordination very strictly, that it would be a tacit or express agreement between two people. And I think that this is really important because what it means is that the entire framework for part one of this report is holding the bar for what he is defining as you know, coordinated activity or conspiracy is this very high bar, which requires, as you know, Renato, from being a prosecutor, it requires states of mind that involve knowledge and intent, you know, things that are expressly agreed upon. And in my experience as a counterintelligence agent, that is not typically how foreign intelligence services operate. And so I think we also need to review what the behaviors that he finds, the actions, and understand the significance of them from a national security perspective as well.
Yeah, I think that's a very valuable way to frame this, Asha, because I will just say from the perspective of somebody who has tried a lot of conspiracy cases and indicted a lot of conspiracy cases, what you have to have is an agreement to commit a crime. And so the two of you have to have a mutual understanding regarding what crime the two of you are going to commit together. And you don't have to each be involved in every piece of it, but you each have to have at least some role in committing that offense and agree to do that. And that can be hard to prove. I mean, my last jury trial, the judge threw out the conspiracy charge mid-trial, given my cross of their cooperator. It can be hard to establish a criminal conspiracy amongst people who are committing a bank robbery or doing a drug deal or something like that. So the idea that you're going to have the Russian government and a candidate for president or a campaign for president, and you're going to prove a conspiracy there on its face is a very high bar. And, you know, my sense of things, and you may have a better sense than I am, is that his view of coordination also, you know, you were talking about an agreement as well. It's very close to, at least the way Mueller defined it, it seemed very close to criminal conspiracy. He was setting a very high bar there. And so, you know, I have used, you know, I don't really know what to make of collusion. Frankly, I wish the term would go away from my perspective as a lawyer. But, you know, I've kind of said, well, Mueller didn't find anything about collusion. A lot of people have been saying to me, well, he found a lot about collusion, but not really conspiracy. And I think a lot of this is a semantics in terms of what you are expecting or understanding collusion to mean.
That's right. So let's also just break down a couple of other things about part one of the report and how Mueller is framing it. He does identify two specific crimes. So the first is the Russian social media and disinformation campaign, which was waged through the Internet Research Agency. This is Russia's troll farm. And these involved 13 individuals and three Russian companies that were indicted. They are litigating this in court right now. The other was the hack of the DNC server, and that for that crime, 12 GRU Russian military officers were indicted. And so really what he's looking at is, you know, that would be the underlying crime, and was there any explicit agreement between members of the Trump campaign to assist in committing those specific crimes. And you have two problems there. The first is that both of those operations, the social media and disinformation and the hacking, you know, they are covert operations. So when governments engage in covert operations, you know, through their spy services, they are also trying to do something called have plausible deniability. So they're trying to leave their government fingerprints off of it, so they can't be identified as being behind it, which means that, you know, it's even harder to the extent that any Americans, let's even leave the Trump campaign out of it, were assisting them, it is going to be very far removed. They were going to be using intermediaries and cutouts and people in between, WikiLeaks figures in here, to kind of facilitate their dirty work. So what I would say about collusion is I think we should think about collusion as a set of behaviors. If we are looking at this from a counterintelligence perspective, was there encouragement of Russia's activities? Was there any facilitating of it? Was there a receptiveness to it? Was there a willingness to benefit from it? All of these, in my opinion, would constitute collusive behavior, even if it does not meet the criminal standard to agree to commit the exact crimes with the Russian government, which is the standard that Mueller's using.
Yeah, I, you know, one thing that's been helpful to me, I've learned a lot over the course of the past year or so, learning from people like you and John Cipher about how intelligence services operate, because that's something that's beyond my expertise entirely, is that there's an element of plausible deniability, right? In other words,
yes.
Yeah, that's, you know, you've talked a lot about that, Asha, and I've learned about that from you, and that really cuts against proof of a conspiracy. It's very hard when you're putting in these intermediaries. You know, for instance, you know, Mueller talks a lot about conspiring with the Russian government. Well, what about with WikiLeaks? I mean, a lot of the stuff that's redacted here is related to Stone's conversations with WikiLeaks. And I thought one of the more interesting revelations in part one that I noticed was that the Trump campaign was aware of future WikiLeaks releases and was planning their strategy around those. So, you know, to a lot of folks, that's basically what they thought of as collusion. That's what they were looking for. I think the misunderstanding there was on the legal standard.
I think that's right. And remember that the CIA has identified WikiLeaks as an intelligence arm, a non-state intelligence actor of the Russian government. Now, there's no reason that the Trump campaign would necessarily know that or care. But in dealing with WikiLeaks, from a criminal standpoint, they're not officially dealing with the government, you know, so there's no conspiracy with the Russian government. But as you just mentioned, Renato, it's still problematic. If you know that this entity, wherever it is, has stolen information from your competitor and you are actually, as you mentioned, strategizing with that entity to weaponize that information in ways that distort the information space in your favor, I would say that that's coordinating, and that's collusion. And, you know, whether or not it was knowingly with Russia, I mean, I think that Trump saying, hey, Russia, if you're listening and you have those 30,000 emails, it seems to me that they had some awareness that Russia also had an interest in this, but it was from a distance. So they're dancing from a distance. And I think that that should still be concerning to us, regardless of, you know, if it can meet this high criminal bar.
I assume when you talk about that, when, you know, at that rally, he said, yeah, come on, Russia, hack her emails or get more information. I'm assuming that that's easily dismissed as, well, that's just Trump saying random things and, you know, being gregarious in his way.
Well,
except that in the report, Patty, Mueller actually details that he details that statement that Trump made and notes that 5 hours later, the GRU attempted to hack into Hillary's email. So, you know, one of the things that you learn in intelligence is there really aren't a lot of coincidences. And definitely when you start to see them pop up over and over and over again, it means that it's not a coincidence. So, you know, I don't think that you know, it happened to just come out of his mouth and he said that, and then they do it that very day. To me, that seems significant.
You know, it's interesting to go to that episode. I had a lot of journalists asking me pretty early on in the Russia investigation, sort of behind the scenes, well, what does it matter legally if the Trump campaign knew about what Russia was doing and was like cheering them on? Or what about if they knew what they were doing, but they were just trying to encourage it in some way, or they were trying to get messages to them? And I said in all those circumstances that wouldn't be sufficient to charge a crime. And I wonder if now, in retrospect, if those journalists knew more than they were letting on to me. In other words, if they were sort of talking to their sources and saying, well, and hearing from them that that's basically what the evidence was going to ultimately show. I will say that, you know, when it comes down to it, to me, all of this is very troubling from a national security perspective. One thing that you and John had talked about when we discussed the counterintelligence investigation earlier, Asha, was about how even if somebody is not a controlled asset, but as an unwitting participant or is compromised in some way by Russia, that can have a very significant impact on our national security. And to me, I think that's the appropriate lens with which to view part one.
Yes, absolutely. And in many ways, an unwitting asset can potentially be more dangerous than a witting asset, right? So a witting asset is someone who is actually being controlled and tasked. And so, you know, you definitely have that interaction, but there's also a certain level of, you know, conscious awareness of what you're doing on the part of the asset. You know, an unwitting asset is valuable to Russia because they can do it from a distance. They can manipulate the strings. They can dangle money. They can offer praise. They can, you know, with a wink and a nod, say, hey, you know, we have the goods on you. And what if, you know, it would be really super sad if, you know, your tax returns just ended up online, for example. I mean, I'm just giving this as a hypothetical, but like, you know, to exploit someone's fear of exposure or humiliation, for example. And when you're using emotional puppeteering like that, that's really, you know, working someone's own vulnerabilities, they are not really acting at a conscious level. And so, you know, I think that it's more dangerous because it could just be that Trump at this point has kind of been lured in and is really willing to place Russia's interests over those of the United States. And I think we've seen that in Helsinki. We've seen that with him suggesting bizarrely in 2017 that he wanted to create a cyber partnership with Russia, slow rolling sanctions, lifting sanctions on Oleg Deripaska. I mean, you know, the list goes on and on of his bizarre behavior that is really inconsistent with our traditional foreign policy. And I think that it's happening because, you know, Putin knows how to play him.
So one thing I wonder about is there going to be another report, like a counterintelligence report that goes to Congress? I always thought that there was supposed to be some sort of counterintelligence set of findings that were going to also come out of this investigation.
Well, I think that we will see counterintelligence findings, and here's why I think we didn't see them here. So, as you know, Renato, the special counsel regulations spell out very clearly what the special counsel is responsible for at the end of the investigation. And one is this confidential report, but these regulations are really written contemplating a criminal investigation. So the final report that's required of the special counsel is about listing the decisions to prosecute and the declinations to prosecute individuals that were investigated during the course of it. So it's really kind of this report is clearly a criminal report. There has to be counterintelligence findings. I mean, we know that they were dealing with what Russia, a foreign intelligence service, was doing. We know that there was a counterintelligence investigation opened on the president himself. We know that there were FISA orders. These are all a part of counterintelligence investigations. They would not be criminal investigations if they're using those kinds of techniques, and that those were garnering foreign intelligence because they were renewed multiple times. So somewhere this... The fruits of those investigations are collected somewhere. I don't know if they've been compiled in a report, but they form a huge backdrop to the report that we're seeing right now, because it will detail exactly what Russia was doing, who they were contacting, how they were doing it, all of those things. And I think there's an open question. I don't doubt the public will see that, or definitely not soon, because so much of it's classified. But I think that the intelligence committees can get to it directly. And I think for that reason, Mueller was smart to not actually include them, even if he had the latitude to, because then it would be under Barr's thumb.
Yeah, I've spoken to one lawmaker since the report was released who was most interested in the counterintelligence findings, and that was really that person's focus. And I think that, you know, it really poses a question of where do you go from here with that? In other words, let's say that there are very disturbing counterintelligence findings. What do you do with that? In other words, you know, we have a mechanism under our Constitution for dealing with high crimes and misdemeanors. What do you do when there's, let's say, a president or somebody around a president who is compromised in some way? You know, what is the remedy for that? A very interesting problem.
Well, I think that of all the high crimes and misdemeanors that would warrant removal from office, foreign influence would be at the top of the list. I mean, this was a motivating and animating concern of the framers of the Constitution. There are multiple provisions that, you know, being a natural born citizen, the emoluments clause, all of these things, and it came up in the convention, it's in the Federalist Papers, this fear that this new democracy might come under the sway of a foreign power that is kind of trying to, and the Electoral College, for example, is also designed to protect that. So I would say that, you know, I think the challenge is going to be that if there is evidence that there is, whether it's Trump or other people involved in the administration are compromised, how do we make that available in a way that does not compromise sensitive methods and sources, and I would say most importantly, human sources that might be in places where they have literally put their lives on the line to provide intelligence to our intelligence services. I think that is the challenge.
I have to say that's one thing that I think is a significant issue here is we have to make sure that we protect classified sources and methods. But at the same time, you have these issues of intense public concern. How could there even be a debate about, for example, whether or not to remove the president of the United States when no one can publicly talk about why that might be or how we...
Exactly.
Very difficult. To me, these are really unprecedented problems for our democracy to have. I think at this point, is one of the remaining questions that I think is really unknown. In other words, there was some reason that gave the intelligence community a reason to launch a counterintelligence investigation of the president of the United States. I do think, rightfully so, that is being questioned by people. In other words, I think that it is important. I think that is such an extraordinary step that people should be questioning why that was opened. And that can be done in a classified setting, in a controlled setting. But then the question is, you know, what the outcome of that is, and how do you let people know one way or the other? And frankly, I would be happy to hear if Trump isn't compromised by the Russians, even though obviously there's some signs that he very well may be. You know, how we make that available to the public and in what context and what do we tell everyone, I think, is a very tricky question to answer.
Yes. Completely. And I actually think that Paul Manafort will be the counterintelligence findings on him will be very important. I mean, one of the things that the Mueller report, the first part, does note is that he was passing polling data to Konstantin Kilimnik and sending who, by the way, is for your listeners, is a person affiliated with the Russian intelligence. And what Mueller says is we were unable to ascertain the purpose of that. You and I can have to take some guesses. I mean, I think that polling data is really relevant to understanding where voters might need to be swayed and where disinformation campaigns, could be successful. That would be my guess. But you know, it's one of these things where I think it shows why Mueller was so keen on pressuring Manafort. I mean, he kept squeezing him with those charges. And I think it's because Manafort really holds the keys to the kingdom in terms of a lot of what Russia was trying to do. And it also shows it's a great example that without getting that information, without being able to get hard evidence in the form of testimony, for example, or other ways that could be admissible in court, he can't charge Manafort with any kind of conspiracy with Russia, even if we have these kind of strange activities that they uncovered.
Yeah, we already know now that Manafort, of course, was promised supposedly by Trump's attorneys that they would be taken care of, him and Gates would be taken care of.
Just about Manafort, I have a quick question.
Sure.
Was there any testimony? Did he explain why he had passed the data along? For funsies? I don't know.
That's something I don't know offhand. Do you know offhand, Nasha?
I don't know, but remember that it was the sloppy redaction in one of his filings where it was that particular action was mentioned in one of the filings by his own lawyers. I suspect, and it was related to the filings that came after Mueller said that he had lied to them in the course of his plea agreement. So, Patty, I think that that's what they wanted to find out, and I think he was lying to them about it. And they knew he was lying to them about it. And that's why, you know, he lost whatever, you know, deal he had in place. But yeah, I think that they were not able to get it from him.
Yeah, I have to say, from my perspective, just to sort of wrap up what we're thinking about, count one for, or count one, my God, I'm such a lawyer. Part one, I'm so used to talking about indictments. Part one, for today, although I suspect that we're going to have a lot more to say about it in the future, Asha, is, you know, from my perspective, one thing that was unfortunate that happened here was that not only did a lot of these details were they revealed in advance, but also the expectations were set such a sky high way. In other words, such a simplistic picture was painted for everyone that, oh, there's going to be this proof of conspiracy and there's going to be a conspiracy charge between the Russian government and the Trump campaign, and it's all there and it's going to be wrapped up in a bow. And I always was, as I think I hope listeners know, I was always very skeptical of that, and I tried to express that in multiple mediums, both in print and on here. But I think that the reality of the problems here are very complicated and very disturbing. And the fact that you can't wrap it up in some neat conspiracy bow, to me, makes it even more challenging to know where we go from here.
Yes, I agree with that. And I think you're right that the media, I mean, I really don't know where to place the blame, you know, because I think people just, they, you know, they watch Law and Order, they watch, you know, FBI shows. So they see things in criminal terms. They think that everything gets wrapped up in an hour, bad guy goes to jail. And that's, you know, the framework that people are used to. But I agree with you. You know, I know that I and John Cypher, who you mentioned, and Alex Finley, who's another former CIA officer, wrote a couple of pieces that said, look, collusion doesn't have to be criminal to be a threat. And we explain how this is a slow process of developing and luring people into doing your bidding without ever saying a word. But I just think that that is a harder thing for people to get their mind around.
I agree. I will tell you, for me, I've learned a lot from you on that subject. I suspect that we're going to be talking a lot about this in the weeks to come, because this is one where we're all just starting to digest this, and I think the implications of it will be revealed. And there's going to be some hearings about this in the upcoming weeks. So thank you very much for joining us again, Asha. You added a lot to this podcast.
Yes,
once
thank
again.
You, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of On Topic. Please subscribe to this podcast, go to your app and review the podcast, and join us for our next episode. I'm Renato Mariotti. Until next time, let's stay on topic.